Hey everyone, welcome to the All Things XR podcast. In today's episode, I have the pleasure to have Matt Meisnicks again on the All Things XR podcast. Matt is an absolute legend on AR and VR field and the former CEO of 60AI, which got acquired by Niantic, and the current CEO of Deja Vu. Hi, Matt.
Hi. Thank you for having me back.
Welcome again. So Matt, thanks very much for accepting my invitation for the podcast. And for those of our listeners who might not know you, can you introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. I've been working in this space of AR, VR, XR, you know, computer vision for the last 15 years or so, mostly as a entrepreneur of some sort, a little bit of investing, early stage investing. You know, have a technical background, but ended up on the commercial side of things. And I've been really, you know, working to understand how to connect the real world and the digital world together, how to solve software problems that help us believe that, you know, the real world and the digital world, that boundary gets a bit blurry, and how to kind of blur it even further. You know, I had a couple of companies that failed. I had one that 60AI that was acquired by Niantic, and I was very pleased to see just in the last month or so, Victor Priscaru, my 60AI co-founder, who's the chief scientist at Niantic now, published this great paper talking about how Niantic is really building out to the same vision we had in the earliest days of 60, and how do we build this sort of map of the world that, you know, lets you understand the world and then starts to enable all these new use cases and new applications that can be built on top of that map. That's been great because you hear often about startups that disappear, you know, once they get acquired. And I feel like that's really encouraging, seeing that vision we had, which was 8-9 years ago, we called it the AR cloud. You know, that's still being built out and still being validated, and still lots of companies are investing in that, you know, in that concept. So it's been great to hear. And now, you know, just this year, we started a new company called Deja Vu, which is working on the same sorts of, same sort of themes.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So Matt, what inspired you to start Deja Vu? Can you tell us a bit more about Deja Vu?
Well, yeah, I mean, that idea of sort of blending the worlds together has always been of interest to me. I think it's just a fascinating, just so much sort of comes out of that. And it's fundamental to, you know, virtual reality and augmented reality and everything we believe might happen when all that stuff works. And but this particular company came about, you know, like at the intersection of a couple of things, you know, we saw happening. You know, one of the biggest was a lesson we learned at 60AI, where we're fortunate to work with Airbnb on, you know, an idea they were exploring, which was letting hosts scan their homes. And then on the listing for that home, you could have a 3D model of that house. You could do a walkthrough, you could get a sense of, you know, the layout and the size of it and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, we were excited because this was, you know, a lot of the idea that drove the creation of 6D. And what came out of that was that's a really bad idea. First of all, hosts are terrible at scanning. They can't really, they miss bits and, you know, they never get a complete scan. But most importantly, the scans didn't look perfect. They looked like a 3D scan. They looked like a video game, you know, at best. And what happened was the conversion rates for those listings that had those scans actually dropped, you know, versus regular photos. And my lesson in that sort of stuff was that if you are going to tell someone that this is a virtual copy of a real thing, a real place, it needed to be perfect. Like, it needed to be visually perfect, at least visually perfect, sound and interaction, all that stuff as well. But and that just wasn't possible at the time, but it kind of stuck with me. And in the intervening 4 or 5 years since then, we've just seen a whole bunch of things come together, like really exciting, that things like, I've seen game engines just take leaps and bounds in terms of their capability, you know, Unreal Engine in particular. We've seen new computer vision research around perfs and Gaussian splats, which were a way to kind of use your phone and get something that looks a lot more photo or video like than video game like. They have their own problems, but, you know, it was a big leap forward. And we saw devices start to come to market that had enough pixels in front of your eye that it was, you know, indistinguishable. Like you couldn't see the pixels, you couldn't see the screen door effect, and that super high resolution displays kind of meant, you know, if you had a high enough quality image, like a photo or a video, you know, it looked real. It looked as real as something on a TV or on cinema. But there was still a problem. And that problem was, although definitely in cinema now you can create these virtual sets that are indistinguishable from reality. You know, most movies, like not just the Avengers or any of those sort of superhero ones, but just regular documentary type drama films, you know, the background might be a city from, you know, they need to de-age a city, and that might be New York in the 50s behind me, and that'll all be digital. And you just, it's impossible to tell. It's not real. Like you can't tell where the physical set begins and the virtual set, or physical set ends and the virtual set begins. Although it was possible, the problem was it was still very compute intensive. And although the game engines were getting pretty close to that level of quality and being interactive, you needed like a super high-end PC to run it. But to get something on a battery-powered device, you know, whether it was a phone or a tablet or a headset, and with these high-res displays, it just wasn't possible. So that problem, you know, was, I thought, interesting. If someone can solve that problem, then we can unlock a lot of use cases and kind of do a big leap forward in terms of, you know, the user experience of all these types of media and entertainment and, you know, e-commerce and all this stuff was there, simulations. And then about, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, I was introduced to my co-founder at Deja Vu through John Gatta, who'd worked on the Matrix films. And we realized that he had invented, it was very similar to 6D, you know, with Victor, and that he had invented some technology that was quite amazing. And he was a very deeply technical person with no, you know, no real strengths in communicating, you know, what that tech could do or how it would work or who it was for or how to sell it. And, you know, I knew that that was something I was kind of uniquely good at, and that because I had the background to kind of understand the tech and the commercial side to sort of explain it. And, I thought, yeah, this is an interesting problem with a type of company that, you know, I'd had success with in the past, and we should give it a shot. So that was kind of the spark led to the foundation of or the founding of Deja Vu.
Awesome. So Matt, you recently published a post which I recommend to anyone who's listening to this podcast, and you coined a new term, cinematic reality. Can you tell us a bit more about that, what it is, and what Deja Vu is trying to do with it?
Yeah, God, I don't want to be coining new terms. This industry is full of too many. And I think cinematic reality was actually used by Magic Leap, you know, early on. But I'm sort of using that terminology to try and explain the difference between what we think about when we talk about 3D models, 3D scans, and, you know, what everyone thinks is enough versus what is actually enough to actually make these use cases real. And I called it cinematic reality, or I used the phrase cinematic just to kind of differentiate from photoreality, because everyone says, oh, it's photoreal. This scanning app is photoreal, or this game is photoreal. And they kind of look like a photo, but they're not actually useful. That was the difference, where in cinema, these shots are used. They have a purpose. You know, they're there to tell a story. So there's this gap between what you could capture in a 3D scan, what the latest computer vision research with Gaussian splats and stuff was enabling, modeling tools were sort of enabling, and getting to the point where it's actually a useful 3D scene for a purpose. And it always reminded me of the, you know, the Airbnb thing going back, in that just doing a scan of the property isn't good enough. Like it's a negative. So you need to be able to get to the similar type of feeling that a professional photographer could achieve in that Airbnb listing. They, you know, they get the right aspect of the light out the window. They stage everything, they can tweak it afterwards to make it get the color all right, and like put filters on it and stuff like that. And I thought unless these 3D environments can be creatively adapted, then they're just kind of a waste. It's like an iPhone snap. You know, you're never going to use iPhone snaps in your marketing campaigns, you know, or you're not going to use your quick 3D scan in a marketing campaign for an immersive marketing campaign. So that's kind of what I tried to explain, you know, and what I called it cinematic reality. And because we had, you know, banged our head against this problem, not just the technology, but the, you know, the go-to-market and the use case side, we felt that was like essential, you know, in anything we built. And all our tech was built with that, you know, that sort of enabling that in mind. And we were, you know, we're talking to investors, we're talking to potential employees, and people were getting kind of confused between, oh, can't you just do that with a Gaussian splat app? Can't you just do that, you know, with sort of something, some game engine? And we sort of would then get in this long-winded explanation about trying to, you know, trying to explain the difference between what we're doing and what, you know, what a phone app does. And so I wrote the post and came up with that term to sort of help educate people as to the distinction.
Awesome. So Matt, can you tell us a bit more about the mission, the challenge you're trying to solve with Deja Vu? So you're trying to actually create a new rendering technique, new rendering technology to put these on battery powered devices, something like that?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, from a technical point of view, obviously it's a proprietary engine. Mm-hmm. The way it broadly works is, you know, if you've got a scene from a game engine that's like 4K type textures, don't talk to us. You know, stick with Unreal, stick with Unity or whatever, and get that working. There are, you know, for the cinematic reality or whatever you want to call it, like the sets that are used in virtual cinema, big architectural models, huge photogrammetry scans for simulations and things. Those, you know, those 3D assets, 3D data sets are just massive. They're like, can be terabytes in size. I mean, definitely tens or hundreds of gigabytes in size. And people that are, and that's kind of how much data it takes to make it look perfect, you know? So the people that have got those assets, that art, to get that to run interactively at the moment is a, you know, you need to throw a bunch of tech artists at it. They need to work at something for weeks. They downscale the quality, they decimate the meshes, they reduce the texture resolution, they bake in lighting, like all this sort of stuff just to get it to run, you know, on a either a low end phone, emerging markets, you know, all of those phones in India and China and stuff that are, you know, emerging phones, or high end headsets. It's the same problem. We've got very, very low power chip to drive a relatively high number of pixels. And so to do that, you know, by hand it's a couple hundred grand, $100,000, $150,000 up to like $250,000 of people's time, plus a month, 6 weeks of, you know, elapsed time, to get something that works and still doesn't look as good as the original. And so we solve that problem. We say, look, you may be a visual effects studio, you've developed some amazing thing for the Sphere in Las Vegas, or you've done some gigantic photogrammetry scan of a massive real estate development. We just say, look, give us the data, you know, just give us the terabytes of data, and we can turn that around in, you know, less than a day and say, here's a, you know, 100 meg size file that is exactly the same visual fidelity as your source data, and it runs on low-end devices. And that's kind of the problem we're solving.
Awesome, awesome. So Deja Vu is kind of more on the VR side than the AR side, right?
Or mobile. You know, we're not only immersive. Like I definitely, you know, we're approached by a huge gaming company last week, and they don't really care that much about headsets, but they really care about emerging markets. They want, you know, 1 billion people in India and have many people in China and Southeast Asia and these markets where people have sort of low-end Android phones with like a chip that's several generations old because it's cheap and cheap displays. And they're like, well, how do we get an iPhone quality game to run on these phones? And, you know, obviously a lot of it is the interaction and the gameplay and all that stuff, but the compute budget is largely driven by the graphics. And so we're able to say, okay, we can ingest that, you know, iPhone quality, you know, asset and optimize it even further so it runs on this old, you know, old technology phone and lets them give the same sort of iPhone user experience now to another billion users. And that kind of market opportunity is probably more, you know, commercially exciting than, you know, the latest and greatest headsets that, you know, are about to be released.
Awesome. So it's not necessarily a 3D scanning of a real environment, a simulated environment, 3D generated environment.
Yeah. If you look at our website right now, the djv.ai website, we have a little demo video and a test flight you can download that shows we call it Dune, you know, like a Dune scene. We don't have any connection to the, you know, the official IP of the movie, but we created a scene that is exactly the same as what they used in the movies. We used an up-to-date version of the tool chain that DNEG used to make the virtual sets for the films. Every single grain of sand is rendered. Every single grain of sand has depth. Every little blade of grass has depth. And that was about I can't remember how big exactly. It was several hundred gigabytes in size. So it was completely synthetic. We did it all. There's no photogrammetry. There's no 3D scanning. But it looks perfectly photoreal. That's the type of thing we can ingest. So it can be a completely synthetic scene. It can be a photogrammetry. It can be a Gaussian splat scan. It could be a generative AI, you know, created
yeah.
in a 3D world. It's just that it just needs to be like really big, really high quality. And it's wherever it comes from, as long as it's that super high quality, we can make it work on today's device.
You mentioned generative AI created scenes just a few days ago. World Labs published a demo. Did you see that?
Yeah. And today Google published one called, not Gemini. Oh, God, I can't remember what they called it. It was like this Cat 4D, and then there was another one as well, but it was the same sort of thing. But the Google's one was even a bit better than what World Labs did.
I haven't seen that.
Like open doors, and actually the world would react. It's incredible, you know, where that's going. Yeah. So that's the sort of stuff we're not trying to be that.
Yeah.
I think no matter what, like even if those tools get to the point in a few years that they can create not just a mobile phone, something that looks good in a mobile phone video, but actually can work on a fully immersive, like 5K per eye sort of device, you still got the same problem of how do you draw those pixels very
exactly.
rapidly. And that's the problem we solve. Then, as I learned at 6D, you might have an amazing paper that's published, which we did, you know, when we started 6D, and it took us 2 years to get from a demo of the paper that was blew people away to an app in the App Store, you know, and probably would have taken us longer after that. Like only now, like Niantic is kind of building out that vision, which is another four and a half years later. So I'm not, you know, it's as a founder, you sort of see this stuff and you kind of get really excited by it. But as a CEO, I'm very focused on, you know, where is the budget today? Like where is money being spent on 3D environments? And what are the actual, you know, how do you really solve this problem? You know, not just a cool demo, but these creative agencies need to be able to color grade the whole thing. They need to be able to color grade different segments of it. They need to be able to edit it and move rocks around. They need to be able to dynamically change lighting, very fine grade control. It needs to work with their existing tool chains. All of that sort of stuff is not even considered in these research papers, but it's necessary in order to get to get paid.
Awesome. So Matt, what technological breakthroughs have allowed the Deja Vu to run these 3D data sets in real time on mobile devices?
It's really something that my co-founders worked on, you know, and developed. It's been something for many, many years. You know, he's kind of looked at this problem and tried to solve it. And we describe it as we ingest it into our cloud and we process it there and we give you a very small, simple asset on the outside of it. It's sort of like, we say it's like the love child of Unreal Engine's Nanite with Google's Surat that they developed 5 or 6 years ago. And if you took both of them together and combined the best of both, and then plugged in some other capabilities around your animation and relighting and interactive triggers and things, that's kind of what Deja Vu roughly looks like.
Awesome. So Matt, again, on your blog post, you mentioned cinematic reality can create emotional connections with users. Can you elaborate more on that?
Our tech doesn't make it emotional. Like that's really the job of the storyteller. You know, the creative person has to decide, okay, I've scanned this house, you know, this apartment behind me. How do I make it moody and romantic? You know, and we don't do that. We just sort of go, look, here's a bunch of levers and stuff that you can pull to change the lighting, to make it dim, to make the fireplace work, to, you know, do all of those things that a cinematographer would do in a film to make it feel like a romantic place. Or they say, no, we want it to feel like energized and bustling, and you'd want the lights really bright, and you'd want, you know, a totally different look and feel to exactly the same scene. So that sort of fine-grained creative control doesn't yet exist in other tools. Like you can do it in Unreal Engine for sure. You can do it in Houdini and all these types of VFX type tools. But doing that in Gauss and Splats or in some of these generative AI tools, that's just kind of science project stuff at the moment.
Awesome. So besides gaming, what are the applications and use cases for cinematic reality that you're particularly excited about?
Yeah, I actually think gaming is one of the least interesting use cases. Largely because games, you know, the visual quality of a game is usually just a minor aspect. It's the fun, it's the gameplay, it's, you know, the IP it's based on. Like all that stuff is what makes a game compelling more than just, oh, it looks pretty. But where the use cases where we're really getting earliest traction is in definitely real estate, you know, like high-end real estate, where they want a better experience, a better immersive experience than, say, Matterport can give. Matterport's kind of the only game in town at the moment. So we've been approached by a lot of, you know, I've got five or six of those companies kind of already asking us and giving us test data and stuff. Then the next is visual effects studios. Generally, they've already created art for some other project and they're like, oh, how do I make this thing I did for a film or thing I did for a ad campaign? How do I now make that like an interactive, immersive thing and reach a whole new audience? And so they're ready to go and they're keen to work with us. Then we've got these are kind of the same, but we've got the hardware manufacturers are really interested in basically connecting their new devices to their media and content assets. So, you know, I can't really give specific names or anything like that, but if you look at what, say, Apple did with Vision Pro and connecting it to Apple TV, and they've got now, you know, they did that amazing thing with The Weeknd, that music video, immersive music video. They did that short film with the submarine and stuff. They did the dinosaur encounters. Like these are entertainment, media entertainment, not sort of gaming. But there's a lot of, you know, a lot of people trying to understand how do I take a media library that I've got a partnership with or I own, and how do I turn that into something that's fully immersive in a 6DOF way, not a 3DOF 360 video way. And that's what we can do for them.
Awesome. So Matt, you partnered with A16Z program. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. Yeah, we're very, very fortunate to be invited to take part in their Speedrun Accelerator program. That's a new or reasonably new accelerator program, I guess, that their Games Fund has set up for the purpose of not really backing game studios, but backing technology companies that leverage technology that was traditionally from a game used to make games. So 3D engines and 3D graphics are obviously simple that, you know, XR is part of that. And yeah, they really just invested some money, gave us access to all of the resources of 16Z for legal and recruiting and HR and just advice, you know, fundraising advice. And the most valuable thing though, is we got to meet or mingle with a whole bunch of other founders that were part of our cohort. I mean, to be honest, I expected that to be not very helpful for me. Like, you know, Deja Vu is like my fourth startup now, and I've made a lot of mistakes already, and, you know, had a couple of things went right. But what was really impressive was that all the other founders were like repeat founders or reasonably senior executives that were starting a company, and there wasn't really anyone who was just like a new college graduate who was like, oh, I want to do a game company. You know, it was really amazing the way they pulled that cohort together. And I think all of us were equally surprised that everyone else had, you know, quite a bit of experience, and we knew how to do the basics. And so you could sort of talk about, you know, go to market challenges or, you know, positioning or messaging type problems in a pretty good way. So I would encourage anyone who's got the type of company that Speedrun might look for to, you know, give it a shot, take a look.
Awesome. So Matt, you mentioned it's your fourth startup, I think. And just a personal question, what made you to start another startup? Because we all know the kind of stress, anxiety, challenges, and all these things. And you are a very successful founder, and you've exceeded your past startups. What made you to start this journey again?
Well, two things. Firstly, you forget. I from what I understand, like when a woman has a baby, you know, you kind of, a couple of years go past, and you kind of forget the pain, and it's, you know, you just remember the cute little baby. So I imagine it's similar to that. I took 2 years off, and when I was thinking about doing this, I got excited by the idea, and, you know, we're just under a year into it now, and I'm like, oh my god, I forgot how hard this was, I forgot how stressful it was. But, you know, I mean, I've got two kids, and, you know, it's the difference between the first kid and the second kid. You know, the first one, you know, every time it coughs, you like drop everything and run across the house to see it's okay. Second kid, you know, it can be like licking a knife, and you're like, don't worry, it's fine. You know? And because you just kind of get, you get better at knowing what to pay attention to and what not to. So it's still as difficult, but you're not personally as like whiplashed around as you were, you know, in the earlier startups. So, you know, there was that. And then, you know, 6D was a great exit. We did well, but, you know, I didn't buy my yacht and sail around the Mediterranean and, you know, any of that sort of stuff. So I still have personal ambitions. I think the market is not yet won. There's tons of opportunity. And yeah, I thought, look, I got to do something. Let's give this a go. I couldn't bear the thought of going and getting a, you know, a job at a big tech company and just sort of working 9 to 5 every day.
I see. Great. Well, Matt, back to AR and VR stuff. What are the most significant trends currently shaping in AR and VR industry that excites the most?
Well, in my sort of little world of the areas I look at, you know, you can't. Even with 6D AI, you know, like AI is really, it's like a cliche to say it, but specifically, it's exciting to see recently in the last maybe 3 months, like so much of the research kind of shifting away from text and 2D images, and now we're getting into 3D. And the two sides of that coin are creating 3D and then understanding the world in 3D. That stuff, and that's, you know, applies to robotics and drones and autonomous vehicles just as much as it does to, you know, AR, VR. But I'm excited just to see that, you know, potential and those breakthroughs just keep happening and happening and happening. And then the other one that's excited me was definitely Meta demonstrating their Orion glasses, which were their see-through glasses. Not because, you know, it's like, hey, it's finally happening, but I think, you know, I think people's expectations with the Apple Vision Pro were way higher than Apple's own expectations for that device. When it didn't turn into the next iPhone, like a lot of the press, a lot of the investors, a lot of just general enthusiasts, I think we're getting a little bit like let down or disillusioned, and, you know, like folks like us have been disillusioned every year, you know, so it wasn't a surprise. Facebook coming out or Meta coming out and saying, look, here's a genuinely advanced the state of the art. We have, you know, shown that our commitment to this space is not wavering. It's not just like money down the drain. This is something that, my God, it actually, you know, isn't some giant helmet that you put on your head. It kind of, you can sort of see how you get from Orion to these. That was, you know, just a good thing for me to see. So those two developments, I think I'm viewing it as sort of long-term, the most interesting.
Awesome. So Matt, you have a very famous quote that AR is UI for AI.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you see that one quote now? How do you see that statement after all these AI advancements?
More and more true. Yeah. Just more and more true. Like it's like everything, like when I came up with that little phrase, it was, because in my head, everything that's happening now, I could, you know, that was kind of I wasn't describing at the time what was going on. I was describing like today and tomorrow, in that, you know, ultimately AR, I mean, it is a user interface. It's not a market. It's not a product. It's a type of interface to, you know, of between the digital world and the real world. The way that interface is going to connect to data and logic and, you know, all of that sort of understanding and reacting and perceiving, that needs to be AI that mediates that. Like, there's no other way for that to happen. So in that way, you know, things like Meta's Ray-Bans with their, you know, their version of Siri in it, you can say, what am I looking at? And it'll have a go at telling you, you know, what it is you're looking at. And it's that type of stuff where, you know, the AR and AI really start to become like, you know, front end and back end of, you know, of these, you know, these products.
So Matt, in your opinion, what are the biggest barriers for widespread adoption of AR and VR technologies?
I don't think they've changed in the last decade. You know, we just need a successful consumer device, hardware device. And I think Meta's Ray-Bans have certainly shown that, you know, you can have a very commercially successful product if you get the fashion side of it right. We're seeing Orion, you know, and even Vision Pro kind of show that all the pieces exist. You know, like, we're not like, it's not like we're waiting on something magic. You know, it's just like, we just need to take everything that's already there and just make it a bit better and put it all together, you know? And so that line of sight is there. I still think it's several years before we get there, but that's, until that happens, this space is, you know, the challenge as an entrepreneur is don't try and build a consumer hit product. Focus on enterprise, focus on deep tech, maybe gaming on Quest. You know, you might get lucky with a hit, but yeah, like a regular consumer product, it's such a, that's a difficult target to hit.
I see. Totally agree. So Matt, what is your long-term vision for Deja Vu and what are your long-term goals for the company?
Look, we want to build the matrix. We want to build the hologram, you know, but not in a bad way. But no, I definitely think that, you know, if you can just, you know, if we can sort of make this possible and we start hosting a lot of these photoreal or cinematically real places and spaces, and, you know, we get to thousands, millions of these places that you can just jump from one to the next, like the way you might switch between one Roblox game and the next Roblox game, you know, jump between these things. But it's not just gaming, you know, it could be looking at something, you know, a house to buy or a vacation property to go to, or it might be a game, or it might be, I want to train my staff on how to do this particular task, you know? And, you know, where our vision is kind of to be the place where all of that is hosted and served up and enabled, and, you know, make these types of experiences and use cases possible.
Awesome. So Matt, as of our last question, what advice would you give to aspiring entrepreneurs looking to enter the tech space?
If you want to be an entrepreneur in this space, build something that you know you can sell today. You do not hope that, you know, if there's 10 million or 20 million Quest is in the world today, make sure you're building something for the Quest 3, then that's it. Don't expect there to be 100 million Quests. If you are building something for, you know, you got to develop a kit for like Snap's new spectacles or Orion, don't expect that product to be in the market. You know, so you've got to you've really got to think, like, what can I sell today and not get excited about the future.
Yeah, totally agree. I myself have fallen for that mistake.
We all have. Because the future is so seductive. It's so exciting.
Exactly.
Usually it's further away than whatever runway you have for your company.
Yeah. Totally agree. Well, Matt, it was an honor to have you again on the All Things XR podcast. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.